on digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
5 Lives, Checkered Flag podcast.
The former world motor racing champion Ayrton Senna has been pronounced clinically dead after a crash at this afternoon's San Marino Grand Prix.
This is the blackest day for Grand Prix racing that I can remember in the many, many years that I've been covering the sport.
By being a racing driver, you are under risk all the time. And by being a racing driver means you are racing with other people. And if you no longer go for a gap that exists, you're no longer a racing driver.
Ayrton has a small problem. He thinks that he can't kill himself because he believes in God and things like this. And I think that's very dangerous for the other drivers.
I shall have a lot more to learn as a man than a racing driver because there is a lot to go, a lot to learn, a lot to do still in life. And happiness will come when I feel complete as a whole, which definitely I don't feel today. But I have plenty of time to fulfill that too.
Ayrton Senna was killed on the 1st of May 1994 when his Williams car crashed into a wall at the San Marino Grand Prix at Imola. He was 34. At that time, he'd won 3 world titles and was lauded as the greatest driver of his generation. This week, a film of his remarkable life from poverty in Brazil through some of the most dramatic and exciting motor racing ever witnessed to his tragic death hit screens around the country. And that's what we're talking about for the rest of tonight's 5 Live Sport. You'll hear from his nephew, Bruno Senna, who followed his uncle's footsteps into Formula One, from his race engineer through the days of success and controversy at McLaren, from his greatest rival, Alain Prost, and after 10, we'll ask if he was the greatest of them all. With me in the studio, former F1 driver John Watson, a man who witnessed every one of Ayrton Senna's Grand Prix races, Maurice Hamilton as well, both were at Imola on that fateful day, and with me in the studio too, the producer of the new film called Senna, that's James Gay Rees. Evening to you all.
Evening.
Let me start with you, John. When you hear the name Ayrton Senna, what first comes to mind?
Well, the hairs in the back of my neck rise because I only raced against Senna in a Grand Prix once, and I experienced something which I'd never seen another driver complete on a circuit. And it made me realise at the age I was that while I could still drive a racing car, what that young man, and he was 24, 25 at the time, was achieving was something beyond anything that I could do. But more importantly, I'd not seen any other driver manage to. It was as if he had 3 hands and 3 feet. And this is on a day when you had normal gear change, normal clutch pedal, brake, steering wheel. There was no modern electronics. And he's just had the capacity, the mental capacity, to carry out so many different tasks right on the outside edge, not on the edge, but the outside edge of the car's performance, and still get through the corner. And it was just mesmerizing. I mean, I've got now those tingles, the very tingles I had, what, going back, I can't, 16 or 26 years, whatever it was, 1985.
Did you have tingles as well, Maurice?
Oh, yes. From a media point of view, he was just a gift because not only was he doing incredible things on the track, like John's referred to, but also, as you heard from some of those clips, when he was giving a press conference, it was very thoughtful, very deep, very meaningful, and particularly as this, you know, wasn't his natural language, he was so articulate in many, many ways. And in these days of manufactured sound bites almost that you get from drivers, Ayrton Senna was just giving you screeds and screeds of copy. And sometimes it was very controversial. Sometimes it was incredibly thoughtful and just giving you an insight into a racing driver's world which you wouldn't normally get.
James, the film itself was something you've wanted to make for a while, wasn't it? And connected to your father?
Yeah, he was the account director for John Player Special when they sponsored the Lotus, the black and gold Lotus that Ayrton drove, you know, his second car basically in sort of 85, 86.
This is the race I'm referring to when it was in the John Player Lotus.
Yeah, exactly. And so my dad would basically go and do these shoots around the Grand Prix. And he just used to come back, and I was about sort of 16 at the time. He'd come back and just say, there is just this guy. My dad was quite tight with Elio De Angelis, but he said, this guy is completely other. There's something about this guy which you can't put your finger on. He's so intense. And for a young, you know, he wasn't like the rest of the young bucks on the paddock. He was very, very intense. Obviously took it incredibly seriously. And it just really captured my imagination from that point onwards, basically. And it was the 10th anniversary of his death that Simon Barnes wrote this great retrospective piece in The Times that I read one half term, I think, and that was the trigger, really, for making a film, because I was making movies by that point in time. And that's the process started there, really.
And you went out to see the Senna family,
yeah.
And you kind of pitched, I suppose, is the best way to describe it, what you wanted to do to them.
Yeah, it was tough, because they'd been approached by lots of very, very big filmmakers, like Michael Mann, Ridley Scott, Oliver Stone, apparently. I mean, loads of people had thought about making the movie, because it's such a great natural narrative. And I think the key to getting them on board was fundamentally suggesting a feature documentary as opposed to a kind of Hollywood movie, which obviously has to have a villain, even more so than we have our own villain. And they really like the idea of Ayrton telling his story in his own words, basically. And also, from a filmmaking point of view, I just don't think you can cast anybody who could come close to Ayrton Senna. I mean, who would you get to play that guy? I mean, Will Smith was great as Ali, but he's not Muhammad Ali. It's not his fault.
Yeah. You know. But they also felt, that, from what I've read, that previous people who'd been to see them would concentrate on his death, whereas you were more than that. It was about his life and his career and his talent.
I think a lot of people do start with Vimla because it's such an amazing sequence of events over those 3 days. I mean, it's, you know, we did at one point think about structuring the film around Imola and cutting backwards and forwards away from it. But ultimately, the kind of chronological narrative works really well because you have this incredible rise to success, the struggle to stay there, and then things start to go against him. And the demise.
John Morris, you've both seen the film.
Yes.
Obviously with the producer in the studio.
I saw it last week with James in London, the BFI.
Your overall impressions?
It brought back a lot of memories because I got to meet Ayrton, or Ayrton as some people call him, way back in his very early days when he came to Europe, and not during Formula One, but it was a very distant acknowledgement. And then through mutual friends in Germany who befriended Ayrton, and through those friends I got to know him better, certainly from a different perspective than simply being, at that time I was a broadcaster or whatever I happened to be doing. And it was just a way of getting to know a man who was, I thought, very private, and maybe felt that he thought he was misunderstood, and his expression was just taking his racing car to limits that had never been, I'd never seen a driver previously access. And basically being able to achieve it, getting away with it.
Did you feel, Morris, an arc of sadness whilst watching the film? Because obviously you know how it ends.
Well, I've seen it twice. The first time was in Brazil in October, November. And at that time I was doing a review of it for my column on GrandPrix.com. So I was totally focused and paying attention, sitting on the edge of my seat, desperate to try and take it all in, because there is so much coming at you. Mm. Even though you know about his life, and even though you know him, you think you do, there was just so many bits in this film that I hadn't seen before, clips of film that I hadn't seen before, and all sorts of stuff. And I, when I finished and wrote my review, I thought, well, that's okay. I've seen it, and it was very impressive. I went a second time to chaperone somebody. It was a prize winner that I was involved with. We got tickets for them, and I took them along. This was in London. And I thought, well, I've seen it already, so I'll go and see it again. And I couldn't believe how much I'd missed first time round, because this time, the second time, I was much more relaxed. I just sat back and I just took it all in. And I was emotionally drained the second time, more so than the first time. It was extraordinary.
Was it emotionally draining to make because of so much archive footage that you had access to, and to decide what to put in and what to leave out?
It was incredibly difficult, actually, I have to say. I mean, for a long time, I really thought we weren't going to kind of, deliver on it, because there were just so many choices to make, and there were so many things we had to leave out, which we didn't want to leave out. We haven't got Donington in there, which some people think is an absolute crime, but we just couldn't fit it in. And there's a whole bunch of stuff. I mean, we could easily make a sort of, a 4-hour version of the movie. But no, it was difficult because I think, we could have made a movie about Imola, as we discussed. We could have made a movie about Brazil 91 alone. They're such great set pieces, these races. So, it was tough. I mean, at a certain point in time, you just have to say, right, no more archive. You get to 5,000 hours. And, you're never going to end. You're never going to finish the film. So 5,000 hours down to 100 minutes was a challenge.
We'll talk about some of the set pieces, and we'll also talk about his life in Brazil and his religion after 9:30, and we'll talk about Alan Prost as well coming up. But first of all, the man himself, you described him, James, as intent. And is that intense in a, or your dad rather described him as intense, is that intense in a good way? Is that intense in a frightening way?
No, I think it's in a good way. I think the reason, I've got this kind of theory that you can be in any pub or restaurant or dinner party in London on a Friday night and pretty much guarantee that one person in that room will be nuts about Ayrton Senna. There's something about the guy. Mm. He's so incredibly charismatic. And really, the film tries to explore what it is about him that means he has that effect on people. And I just think he's just got the X factor in abundance. I mean, you know, he's just a superstar. I mean, you know, it's very hard to put one's finger on it, but you just kind of fall in love with the guy, you know, kind of can't take your eyes off him.
John Watts, you kind of touched on that for you, maybe it felt like his style of racing made you think about how you drove. And did he change the style of racing?
I think that he used intimidation as a weapon to help him. Because if you can intimidate another driver by coming up behind them quickly, for example, putting yourself in their mirror and putting them under pressure, you create a situation where fundamentally the car under pressure wants to get out of the way. So it then becomes a tool in your armament that when you go into an event, people know, they see the red and white McLaren coming and the helmet, the yellow helmet. It's Ayrton, I know he's going to put me under pressure. Actually, I don't really want that pressure. I want to get out of the way, make it look as if I'm not actually giving ground. I'm going to fight him a little bit into the corner. I might put my nose, but I'm going to pull it back again because I know he's going to pass me regardless. And he built up that reputation. Now, it's not actually something that's terribly difficult to do. Other drivers have done it subsequently, and I'm sure other drivers did it previously. But he was the one driver who maintained that, for example, I will never concede. Now, Alain Prost relates to it in the film, and Nigel Mansell also related to it in another interview recently. Of course, Nigel never conceded, but that's another story. That's Nigel. But the point was that Ayrton was prepared and he convinced his competitors that he was never going to lift. In other words, he would go to the wall. And if he had to crash into the wall with you, so be it. That's difficult to compete with, difficult to deal with if you're a more rational or maybe not quite as strong mentally or whatever he was.
Do you think, therefore, he was a man of contradictions? He was happy for you and him to go into a wall and yet he was incredibly concerned about safety.
I don't think he would have happily gone into the wall. No. He wanted to create the impression that he would have done. I think that's the difference, and he succeeded in doing that.
I think part of it was he actually believed if he came up behind you that he should be in front.
Right.
Because he believed he was the best guy out there. Now, I know all racing drivers think that, but he actually totally believed that. And so right back to in Formula 3 when he was racing against Martin Brundle, there was a time mid-season in 1983 when they had a fantastic ding-dong and Martin had the upper hand for about three or four races. And Ayrton couldn't get his head round this because he'd won, I think, something like seven or eight of the first races. Suddenly there's British boys doing quite well. And it just did not compute in Ayrton's brain. And at Alton Park, he went over the top of him trying to get past him as if to say, get out of my way. You shouldn't be there. I'm supposed to be winning this race. And that's the mentality. It wasn't, I'm going to have an accident and crash and into the wall. I don't care what happens. It's, I should be in front.
And he was completely on top of him, wasn't he? Brundle couldn't get out of that car.
But interestingly, Martin Brundle wouldn't have done the same back to Ayrton because he wouldn't have had either that intensity of belief or conviction. He would have probably backed out of it. And that was the part of the key to, I mean, Senna's been called a great overtaker. Overtaking is a skill. Using intimidation to help you is not really a skill. It's just using a mind game. And I think the mind game factor was a part of Ayrton's whole process of going motor racing.
Is it bullying?
I don't care. This isn't the playground we're in, you know. These are big boys going out and actually, in a form of sport, it's like going into a war. It's a battleground. The point is you're not expecting to come out hurting somebody or even worse, letting somebody get killed. But it is a serious playground. And if you can use intimidation, I did it myself. I thought it was great. I loved it. I would do it any day of the week. I'll still do it today if I get the chance. Going into the car park in Oxford, I'd do it.
you saw, as I said, every one of his races. So, and I was having a look at it on YouTube earlier. The Monaco, when he was in the Tolman, and I mean, it was like a lake, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, 1984. That was when he...
Well, that was him bursting onto the...
It was.
It's the race of Formula 1, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And it was a wet, wet race, and the Tolman was the middle of the grid car. It's the equivalent of a young guy coming into Formula 1 today and, say, being in a Force India. It's a middle of the grid car. You don't really expect it to win, with the greatest respect to Force India. And so he was there in this Tolman, And it was wet, as you say. It was so wet. The place was awash. He started 13th in the grid. After a couple of laps, he's 8th. He just works his way forward. He's just got this incredible car skill. And you're seeing it. You're suddenly aware. This guy's good. This guy is really, really good. And he came right up to Alan Prost, and the race was stopped just as he was about to pass Prost. But there's a clip in James's film, which is very interesting, of that particular race. And it's only a very brief shot, but you see a side-on shot of Ayrton coming through the harbour chicane, and he clobbers that chicane like you wouldn't believe. Mm. It's a brief moment with the right front suspension. And the Tolman team, the guys in the Tolman team will tell you today, although we all say if the race had gone another lap, he would have won, he might well have done. If it had gone much further than that, the right front corner would have dropped off the car because he'd really badly damaged it. But that shows in the film very well.
I
was going to say, that's where Perez crashed this weekend, wasn't it, right there?
Right at the same spot, it was.
Morris Hamilton, John Watson and the producer of the new film, James Gay Rees, are in the studio with me as we discuss Ayrton Senna's career and his personality and his life. Senna's greatest success came with the McLaren team, for whom he won 35 of 96 races and claimed his 3 world titles. His race engineer for those 6 seasons was Joe Ramirez, and he joins us now. Evening, Joe.
Good evening. I was not quite his race engineer. I was the team coordinator of the team.
How would you sum up those 6 years, Joe?
Well, they were absolutely fantastic. Anybody that was with us on those years, they really lives a dream. You know, we have the best of everything and the best 2 drivers in the world, and we enjoy it thoroughly. I think... When Ayrton came to McLaren, Alain Prost was the number one, and that was the guy that he wanted to beat, and he was doing everything to beat that man. And when he did it, he really thought that he has made a dream. That the next thing he wanted to do was world champion, and it happened. So it was a fantastic 6 years, 3 years with the first. The first 2 years that we had Prost and Senna were absolutely superb. But unfortunately, when you have 2 titans like they were in the same team, the same car, it didn't leave. And the second year, that was it. You know, one have to leave. And it was a shame. But as I said, it was fantastic. It was a dream for all of us.
What was he like to work with? Was he demanding? Was he difficult?
He was very demanding. He wasn't the easiest person to work with or for, but then again, he'd always deliver. So we knew that he was demanding too much, but nobody of us mind to work at 110% because we knew that by the time he gets in the car, he was going to produce 150%. So it was always good value. We enjoyed it. And he was such an organized person. Everything he did on his life was so methodical, and it was I personally worked very close with him, and I have to say I learned a lot of the things that how he used to do. He was very, very professional. I think he brought the sport to a different level, and most of the drivers after him, like the Schumacher, the Alonso, came up doing what they see Ayrton do it, or like Alonso, what they heard that Ayrton was doing. And that's the new type of professional driver that they are now.
Was it because he was so methodical and so meticulous that meant he was different to anybody else?
Well, I think he was different to anybody else. I think he was a guy that had this aura on top of him, wherever you saw him. You know, people, if you see Michael Schumacher, Alan Prost walking, you know, okay, it's Alan Prost, it's Michael Schumacher. When you see Ayrton Senna, everybody kind of stopped. Wow, Ayrton Senna. He had such a electricity, such a charisma around him. And he was just brilliant. And the way that, as I say, he did everything, he was so professional. He would have been successful in whatever he chose to be on his life because of the way he conducts his life, not just his personal life, his professional life. No, it was enjoying what listened to John and everybody. They were talking about Ayrton, and he was all right what they said. The guy had this right to be the first one, you know. He didn't think that anybody else had the right to win. It was his, you know. Being second, he was the first of the losers. He hated to be that.
You said that it was enjoyable at the start with Senna and Prost at McLaren, and then the atmosphere deteriorated. It got worse, did it?
Yeah, the first year was fantastic. The second year was starting good. Everything was okay till they got to Imola, and they had a pact in Imola that nobody was to pass anybody after the toss at the first corner. And then the race starts for them. It doesn't matter who gained in the start. Nobody passes till after the tosser. Just always they have to look after the Ferrari and the Williams. They were not going to get ahead. And in the first race, the first start, Alain respected. And then there was an accident. They stopped the race. And on the second restart, Ayrton didn't respect it. And from then on, everything went... went bad, you know. In the same race, Alain was so disturbed by the fact. He was really upset. He spun a couple of times. He still finished second to Ayrton, and he didn't even want to stay to the press conference. He left in a hub. It cost him $5,000. And from then on, he just... The debriefing was separate. Alain made the mistake of making a very long interview with L'Equipe, where he said things that later on he regretted. When Ayrton saw that, he said, that's it. I never will speak with this frog again. And the situation just went bad to worse. And in the end, when Ayrton retired, in the same race that Ayrton was Alain Prost was retiring, the same race as McLaren, as he was Ayrton was racing his last Grand Prix with us in McLaren, and Ayrton won the race and retired, and finally in the podium they shake hands, and it was something that I was trying for them to do for the last 4 years without success. But at the end of it, it was a nice ending, and they would have been friends, because they had so much respect for each other that I'm sure they would have been good friends.
Joe, appreciate you joining us this evening. Thank you very much for that. Joe Ramirez, who was the team coordinator at McLaren during the Senna-Prost years. You were chuckling to yourself, Morris, at certain times of that, as you recall the Senna-Prost.
It really did get quite strong. It actually started, I think, before the incident that Joe refers to at Imola. There was a race the previous year at Estoril in Portugal, where Senna was ahead and Prost was trying to get by, and Senna squeezed him against the pit wall at about 180 miles an hour, and it was very, very close. Guys who were holding pit boards out had to lift them up to get him out of the way, and that was the first time Prost stood back and said, wow, wait a minute, if you really want to win that badly, that's not the way I want to go racing. And that was the start of it. Then the breakdown in communications, or the trust, I should say, at Imola that Joe referred to there, was the next thing, and then it was just steeply downhill from there on.
And I think that particular move, Morris, I mean, I would say that was wrong, because that was a deliberate, premeditated move to push another driver against a wall, as opposed to two going into a corner side by side. But, I mean, there's so many of these things, and you related to that race in Imola. The reason why Alain was so upset, I understand, Morris might be able to confirm this, is that the agreement that Alain and Ayrton had was for the Grand Prix. Sorry, Alain, you didn't get up early enough in the morning. We're having Grand Prix Part 2. There wasn't an agreement for Part 2, and that's why Senna did what he did. Now, it's a very fine line, and, you know, taking gamesmanship to a level which is probably not maybe what I think is truly sporting, but that was the kind of limits that these two guys were working at.
And did that gamesmanship then, as you describe it, then go on to, obviously, in 89 and in 90 at the Japanese Grand Prix? Or is that more than gamesmanship?
It got worse than that, yes. I think that was Ayrton was just trying to wind him up, and he did very, very successfully, from what Joe said, because Alain got into a huff. And so all Ayrton wanted to do was put Alain on the back foot, because he knew, of all the drivers he was up against, his teammate Alain Prost, this is why he'd gone to McLaren, was to pitch himself against the driver considered to be the best. So if he could beat the best, then he, Ayrton, would be the best. And he had to do everything he could to destabilise him, and that was one little trick, and it certainly worked.
You know, going back to prior to joining McLaren, I was at a training camp in Austria with a McLaren guy called Willy Dungel. And Senna was there at the same time, and we were out, you know, doing our exercises. And he asked me about McLaren, and obviously he was going to go there at some point. And he said, what about Alain Prost? And tell me about the team.
And I said, well, you know, it's Alain's team. Ron Dennis and Alain are married at the hip, and Mansour Rouget, the partner, married at the hip. Alain runs the team. If you go there, you're going to have to go in and go in slowly and feel your way in. And he's turned around and said, no, not at all. I'm going to go in and I'm going to blitz him. I'm going to wipe him off the face of the earth, both physically and mentally. And that's what he attempted to do.
We're still going to talk about the Senna-Prost rivalry, and we'll hear from Alain Prost in just a moment. But the two seasons that I mentioned, the 89 and 90 and the Japanese Grand Prix, just explain them, both of them, for everybody in case people aren't aware of what happened in those two races.
In both cases, in both years, the championship was actually being settled at the Japanese Grand Prix, which in the first, towards the end of the season, it was the last race in one case. And in each case, if one driver failed to finish, the other would be champion. And it so happened that it switched. So in the first year, if Alain Prost, I think it was if Senna went out, Prost would be champion. Prost, so this was 89, Prost is leading and Senna's right behind him. And Prost had very cleverly set his car up for the race. Although Senna had been on pole, Prost had set the car up for the race. And he actually was just a tad quicker than Senna. Both identical cars. There's nothing in it. It was an incredible fight between the two. And they came to this chicane at the end of the lap, very tight chicane. And Senna, as we were talking earlier, John was talking earlier about this margin of intimidation which Ayrton would bring to the race. And Prost had said before the start of the race, I am not going to be intimidated this time. I've had enough. If he comes through, we're going to have an accident. Senna tried to come through on the inside and Prost made a very, he's not that sort of driver, he made a very clumsy turn into the corner. They collided. Prost walked away. Senna restarted, was then excluded, which is a whole new story in itself. But that meant that Alain Prost was world champion. We fast forward 12 months. Prost has left McLaren. He's with Ferrari now. And the two of them are fighting for the championship again. And this time, if Prost goes out, Ayrton Senna will be champion. There's a whole to-do about the pole position because he's on pole, Senna, and they switch it around. Again, it's a story in itself. It's politics personified in Formula One. Senna gets very angry because they've switched pole position. He says he's on the dirty side of the track. If Prost gets ahead, which he does, he's going to have him off. And he does. He drives into the back of him at the first corner. I mean, it was the most outrageous piece of driving.
Blatant.
Totally. No question about it.
And really dangerous because it was basically wheel to wheel, wasn't it? Which is, you know, the most dangerous thing you can do in Formula One. You can basically catapult the car.
Well, it was that, not only that, but there were 24 cars coming behind them. It's downhill, accelerating all the way. So they're doing about 150, 160 mile an hour. They turn into this corner at the bottom of the hill. And that's where the incident occurred. The rear wing of Prost Ferrari flew up into the air. How it didn't hit anybody else, I don't know. But that sets the scene for what happened. And then, so therefore, Ayrton Senna, as he climbed from his wrecked McLaren, is the world champion. So, and then the trouble started.
So, sorry, John, yeah.
I mean, all this is in the movie.
Yep.
You see the movie and it's all graphically conveyed on screen. I mean, the one in 89, my view of it as a driver is slightly different to Morris's in that they were racing for the chicane. And in my view, Alain turned in early rather than turning in where he would normally turn in, which led to the two cars colliding. And that led to Alain winning the championship. In 1990, because of the furore over the grid position, again, graphically covered in the film, Alain got the better start from the left-hand side of the track, came across Senna, but then went back slightly to the left and opened a slight gap. Now, the following day, I saw Prost at the airport and said, Alain, why did you open the door? Why did you give him the chance to come and hit you from behind? He said, because I thought if I did that, I could take the first part of turn one flat. I said, it doesn't matter. If you had blocked the corner, he couldn't do anything. He said, it doesn't matter. He was still driven into me. Mm. That was Alain's view.
And do you think it was as blatant as Morris thinks?
At the time, I thought Alain allowed the opportunity to the door to be opened, and Senna stuck his nose down in, knowing full well that I was never going to get through the corner. So it was a blatant move.
He didn't lift off. That's the point. Ayrton Senna did not lift off.
That's what Alain was trying to achieve. From being further out to the left, the first part of turn one, Alain thought, I can take it flat if I give myself a better entry. For Senna was, he couldn't have taken it flat, but he had a car there to stop him.
Let's hear from Prost himself, because this week we asked him how he would sum up his relationship with Senna.
It would be too long to tell, you know, to answer this this question. I know there's a movie. I'm not going to watch the movie. I'm not going to look at it. I have it on CD. Maybe I will watch in 5 years, 10 years, or 20 years, but I don't want to watch it. I've done the story myself. I know everything about the story. So it's like when you have a nice dish, you know, and you don't want to make it, you don't want to eat it cold. And I don't want to answer other questions at the moment. You know, it's a very difficult time. The way the movie is done, I am very suspicious. So I don't want to answer more questions about that, if you understand that.
Could I ask about yourself? Did racing against him bring out the best in you as a racing driver?
You always, in life, you always need rivals, nice rivals, to be even better. That is for sure. And he was obviously the best driver I've met. That is obvious.
Alan Prost talking to our F1 commentator, David Croft. Is he right to be suspicious, Alan Prost?
Well, it's hard to say that when he hasn't seen the film. So, listen, we went to see Alan in Paris, interviewed him extensively, and people who were there at the time say, you know, fundamentally it's fairly accurate, you know. And the film is about Ayrton Senna, though. It's not about Alan Prost, do you know what I mean? It's about their rivalry is a big factor in it, but of course it's coming at it from Senna's point of view. So, listen, given the nature of their relationship, I'm not entirely surprised that, you know, he doesn't feel particularly up for it.
I mean, it has been said that you've made him the villain of the movie, and you kind of alluded to it in our first answer at the start of this show, that we have the villain. Is that fair on him?
No, I don't think, listen, I don't. I think we use the term jokingly. He's clearly not a villain in the kind of classic movie sense. He is the rival to our hero, though, and that's the long and the short of it. Listen, he's a brilliant driver. There's no doubt about it. And for some reason, you know, maybe didn't get the kind of respect that some of the other kind of great champions have had. You know, he's a four times world champion, and was a brilliant, brilliant driver, obviously. But I think it's very hard. It's the perspective is Ayrton's, and that's why he's bound to feel like it's kind of not, you know, maybe that balanced. But the events are the events, and again, we have him on camera at the time talking about the events, you know.
I think to some degree there's a bit of paranoia creeps into all this. I mean, I think it was known at the time that Alan suspected that Honda, who saw Ayrton Senna as their natural son, was getting better engines, more powerful engines. Now, I have no idea if that was the case. I would like to think that Honda wouldn't have done so. But, of course, within that hierarchy in Japanese sport, in particular motorsport, they do have a clear number one, number two, number three, number four, and down it goes. So if that was the case, Honda were looking at Senna as number one and Alan as number two. That would have not been a healthy situation for a great driver like Alan Prost. All he asked for was a level playing field. But when you get one driver who is capable, for example, in qualifying, of dragging more time out of the car, it's not unnatural to see the team think about that driver as he's our guy, really. This other guy, he's great as well, but we love this one because of what he's doing. In Monaco in 1988, Alan Prost got pole position about 5 minutes to go before the thing. He came in, as he always did, stood up in his car, very Napoleon-like. The French press gathered round, and Alan told them how he had won pole. Quietly sent him out of the pits, did a lap which was mesmeric, unbelievable lap. And literally, in the space of the time it took Senna to complete the lap, come back into the pit lane, every member of the press had dissipated. And there was Alain left standing in the cockpit of his car like little orphan Annie.
Does it just come down to ego then?
I suppose racing drivers, like any sportsman, do. There is an ego involved, certainly. But I think it was all about this business of just putting one over. And that example that John described, the pole position at Monaco in 1988, I will never, ever forget that lap because I was standing by the entrance to the swimming pool chicane, which is one of the places you go to see. It's very quick. And we knew he was going to be quick. And the thing, John, about it is that Alan had gone quick, Ayrton had gone out and beaten that time. And that would have been enough. It was it was well over a second. It would have been enough. And he went out again right at the very end and went even quicker. And it was that lap when he came into view. I've never seen anything like it in my life. He came out of what they call the back corner. That's where he first comes into view because we're at ground level. And you see the car, this red and white car with a yellow helmet, is just dancing, shimmying across the track, like to the edge of adhesion and back and catching it and like nothing else, and went past us like a dose of salts. And the whole crowd in the grandstand behind us, which is towering right above you, just rose because everybody knew this lap was going to be. And then there was silence while they waited to hear the announcer say, and of course he said, improvement for Ayrton Senna, and the place went berserk. It was an extraordinary moment.
Let's hear from Senna. This is actually in the film, James. It's an interview that was done by Jackie Stewart.
If I were to count back all the world champions, the number of times they had made contact with other drivers, that you in the last 36 months or 48 months have been in contact with more other cars and drivers than they might have done in total.
I find amazing for you to make such a question, Stuart, because you are very experienced and you know a lot about racing. And you should know that by being a racing driver, you are under risk all the time. And by being a racing driver means you are racing with other people. And if you no longer go for a gap that exists, you're no longer a racing driver, because we are competing. We are competing to win. And the main motivation to all of us is to compete for a victory. It's not to come third, fourth, fifth, or sixth.
But hasn't that always been the case?
But I think it's all irrelevant. All what you're saying, Jack, is really irrelevant. Because I'm a driver that won more races than anybody over the past 3 years. I'm a driver that has been on pole position more than anybody in history. And I'm a driver that won 2 titles in the past 3 years. And I don't think how, I cannot comprehend how you can try to turn things around to say that I've been involved in more accidents than anybody, because that is not true as well.
James, did you get a sense when going through all the archive? I mean, that was quite confrontational, that interview. Did you get a sense of him having a popularity amongst the other drivers?
Ayrton? I think he was probably kind of, he seemed to be quite sort of cold and quite aloof from what I hear from people. I mean, I think he basically, it all ties back into the theme of him basically, you know, being so focused on his own journey. Everybody else is basically irrelevant. I mean, I've heard interviews with him when he would talk about qualifying. Basically, it's just his track. There are no other cars on the track, as far as he's concerned. They're irrelevant to him at that moment in time. So I wouldn't imagine he's probably the easiest person to kind of get along with. I mean, if, I'm sure as a teammate, you know, either, he wasn't particularly easy.
I mean, some of the best bits in the films, you have the scenes of the driver briefings and safety coming up. And the safety of drivers seemed to matter more to him as he went on.
There's this amazing bit we couldn't put in the film, actually, when another driver comes off, and it's in the end credit sequence. I can't remember the name of the driver. It's
Eric Comas.
Comas, exactly, yeah. Mm. And Ayrton had basically been talking to Professor Sid Watkins, the FIA doctor, about what you do in those sort of situations, about how you clear the airway and all this kind of stuff. And actually, he pulls his car over when he sees Comas's crash, runs out, just narrowly avoids getting run over himself, and basically does do the corrective procedures to him, stabilises his neck and all that kind of stuff until the medics turn up. And it became quite apparent as we were looking through the archive that he does get more and more preoccupied with the kind of reality of having crashes and ultimately what could happen to him. And, you know, obviously it's very bizarre because, you know, there's that, there's the Donnelly crash as well. When he goes, he has this thing of having to go and actually see these things firsthand to try and compute and get his head around what it actually means to have a massive shunt and potentially hurt yourself. And obviously, you know, it does play into the sort of subtext of the film, which is that there is this sort of date with destiny coming through.
And he was becoming more and more of a leader of the drivers against the officialdom, was he?
Oh, yes, he was, because he was, you know, you're talking about, would he have been popular with the other drivers? Well, of course, he was seen as the man to beat, so they will never, ever be popular, will they? Because you're talking about a very competitive bunch here. And also, he was slightly, not aloof, but kept himself to himself, sort of quite a private man in that respect. But when it came to safety, as you say, he got more and more into it, and he felt a responsibility for the other drivers because he saw himself as the leader.
As the leader.
Yeah, and this is what he had to do. So when there was Martin Donnelly's shunt at Jerez, he was straight into the medical centre. Rubens Barrichello on that fateful weekend at Imola on the Friday. Of course, he was a Brazilian and he saw him as his sort of protege, but he was straight in and he was standing beside him when Rubens came around. So he was aware, I think, of a sense of responsibility because he was in his early 30s. He'd been around, he was experienced, and other drivers were looking up to him.
And then exasperation with the politics of the sport becomes more and more evident as well.
I think primarily it started in 89 and particularly in Japan at the Grand Prix. And I talked about paranoia with Alain Prost. Well, maybe Ayrton got paranoia about there being a agreement or something between Jean-Marie Bellest, who was the president of the FIA at that time, being a Frenchman, Alain being a Frenchman, and feeling that he'd been stitched up simply over the pole position, which was favouring Alain, who was second quickest, but on the cleaner side of the track. And then the politics that then unfolded, the penalties, and you know, Ron Dennis in the movie again was very, very, very upset by the whole manner in which that situation was handled. And I think either in Adelaide, the race or whatever it was, he actually held a press conference where he went through this whole rigmarole and explained how can it be right elsewhere, but it was wrong in this occasion. Why was Senna penalised and fined and effectively taken out of the championship? So there was a lot going on that it wasn't pleasant.
Did he enjoy racing? There's a poignant bit in the film where he talks about he was happiest, James, when he was karting as a child. Did he still love it when we were going into the early 90s?
I think he always did, actually. I mean, I think basically driving was his answer to everything. I think, you know, he just felt like he'd been put on this earth to go extremely quickly. I mean, you know, it seemed to be his absolute kind of cure-all. And, you know, I think he did live for it. I don't think he lost the passion. I mean, I think he probably got very sort of disillusioned by the politics of it, and obviously did contemplate retiring at one point in time because the politics were so overwhelming. But I think there's that great section in the movie where Ron says, you know, you've got to fight the dark forces. You know, there's only one way to basically come through this, and to get back in the car and kind of prove to everybody that they're wrong, you know. So, yeah, I don't think he lost his passion. I think he actually probably would have gone on for a couple more years and maybe gone to Ferrari.
I'm not sure. I think that when he signed to go to Williams, he looked, I think, for maybe a 2 to 3 year period where he, in fact, would be able to back off from this extreme limit style of driving that he had employed throughout his career. Because the Williams car had been dominant in 92 and 93. Why not in 94 or 5 or 6? Tragically, that wasn't the case. The car wasn't competitive in the early part of 94. But Ayrton's own pride, and if you like, the responsibility that he felt as a three-time world champion, whatever, it was de rigueur that he had to put that car on pole position. He ended up actually probably having to drive a more difficult car, harder to achieve those pole positions than he was doing at McLaren, where the car at times was competitive, but in 92... 93, he didn't have the fastest car. Certainly 93, he didn't. And he was then having to dig deep again, which he really, I think he was beginning to form the future life of Ayrton Senna, be it the Audi importer for Brazil or the Senna Foundation. He was moving in other directions. There was a growth. He also did change, and I think in the film it was apparent, there seemed to be a physical change. He suddenly went from being this youth-like figure to being almost like a man, and it happened overnight. It didn't seem to be progressive.
Let's hear from another man who appears in the film, Bruno Senna, Ayrton's nephew. He's seen with his uncle on various family holidays and home videos, and he, of course, followed in his footsteps to become a Formula One driver. He was only 11 when Ayrton died, but he's watched the film and has been remembering him with our motor racing correspondent, David Croft.
I watched it in the premiere in Brazil, in São Paulo, and it was quite interesting because not only the movie reminded me of quite a few things, it also brought new things to the table that I didn't know about. But the most interesting thing about the movie was that watching it in the cinema with other people, you see other people's reaction. And people really interact with the movie. They, whenever there's something that they think it's unfair, they complain and they shout at the screen. And when there's something they like, they just feel happy, they smile, they laugh. It's really, really impressive how the movie touches people, and it's quite special, I suppose.
How do you feel when we sit and talk about the legend of Ayrton Senna and how great he was as a man and a driver, when to you, he might just have been Uncle Ayrton? I'm not quite sure how you view him. Was he your uncle, or do you view him as the legend, that great of Formula One?
Well, I see him both as my uncle, but also as my great reference in motor racing. And there is a bit of that mystical feeling that everybody has for him. I also have it, because in the end of the day, I was quite young when he died, but not only that, he was not much at home. So whenever he was at home, it was always a special occasion for everybody to be together in the family. There is that feeling of this special person in your family, but also, after you spent a few days with him, then it was just the uncle that was giving you a hard time when you did something wrong or pulling pranks. So it was quite a good time.
What's the one thing that you remember most from your time with Ed?
Well, for me, it was during the holiday times when he was relaxing a little bit at home. it was really good fun. It was always pranks and sports and always action happening. You know, there was always lots of people at home. All the family was together. It was just brilliant, you know, to be able to be with the family all the time like that. We used to have a really good, easy relationship. You know, he was trying to nurture my competitiveness. He really wanted me to learn about the mechanics of machines and engines and go-karts and jet skis and everything. But also, he also treated me like a child. So it was good fun because sometimes I was misbehaving. He would go and tell me off. And one time I was asking him to fly his model aeroplanes. And he's like, oh, okay, no problem. I'm like, oh, that's a win. But my sister was right next to me when I was asking him, and she said something. So I'm like, yeah, he let me do it, blah, and like kind of making fun of her. And she's like, oh, not anymore. Now you've been bad to her. You don't fly anymore. I'm like, oh. So I learned a lesson then. I mean, he didn't want me to poke fun on my sister, but that was both sides, you know. He treated me a bit like an adult one in terms of the competition, but also a bit like a kid when the time was right.
Does the film convey that? Does the film bring out the real man that you knew, even though you were, as you say, a young child?
Of course, the movie shows a great deal of what Ayrton was about. You can never show everything that he was. But I think the movie focuses on the best points of Ayrton and brings them out. And I think it's very important to remember Ayrton for the good that he did. Even nowadays with the foundation in Brazil, we are still benefiting from the good that he did back then. Of course, everybody has good parts and its flaws. And Ayrton was obviously, everybody else, had his flaws. But I think the movie showed his good, aggressive and determined side very, very well.
I don't think we can ever underestimate just what Ayrton did for Brazil. And there is a scene in the movie when the people of Sao Paulo were saying, look, you know, a lot of people shy away from saying they're Brazilian and don't fly the flag. And Ayrton takes the flag to the racetrack each and every week. He's the one man that is proud to be Brazilian. And at a time when the country was going through such turmoil.
Yeah, I think it brought pride for the Brazilian people. I think when you're a nation where you have very few worldwide references, like Pelé was and like Ayrton was, where people know him and they fly the flag for the country, you always feel a bit like inferior, let's say. That's how Brazilian people used to feel before Ayrton. The country was going through a very difficult time, and I think it helped bringing some happiness to the Brazilian people and believe that for the people to believe that they could be winners as well.
How good, in your opinion, because you're the best person qualified because you've been in Formula One as well, how good was Ayrton Senna as a driver?
Well, it's even for me, it's very hard to quantify. I think he was very special in many ways. Certainly one of the fastest drivers ever. I don't think many people could take as much out of the car as he could in a qualifying lap. But also he was quite greedy, quite determined on his racing. Really, that gut feeling he had that he wanted to win more than everybody else, that was something that used to drive him a lot. Was he the greatest in qualifying? I think he was, yeah. I mean, if he was the greatest in racing, it's hard to say. The times have moved on so much since the time he was racing, and even in his time, the cars used to break down a lot, so you can see many times he was leading a race and then the car would just fail or run out of fuel. Many things that don't happen nowadays. So subjectively, of course, and I'm biased to say, I think he was pretty up there.
Final question. Will there ever be another Ayrton Senna in Formula One?
I don't think so. In terms of talent, maybe yes. It's very hard to say. But in terms of being the person, I think he managed to get all the ingredients together to be a successful guy, very successful in his sport, but also have a different thing outside the track that everybody could see, but nobody could really measure. And that's, I think that's very rare.
Bruno Senna with David Croft. Just a couple of texts to throw out there, 85058. John Wasson, this is for you. David and Lewis, why does Schumacher get slaughtered for ruthlessness, yet Senna was even worse and is adored?
It's a difficult question to answer. I mean, both of them have been guilty of some pretty, you know, bad moves. I think maybe with the growth of television in the last 10, 15 years, there's even more now available to see on your screen. I mean, literally in your living room, you can see an infinite amount more that goes on the racetrack than we had the right or the opportunity to see. So there probably were things that were taking place in the late 80s, but we just simply didn't see them because there wasn't the technology available to convert to the medium.
And Morris, for you, John, in Workington, had Senna lived, would he have won more world titles? How would he have fared with Schumacher and his antics? It's the other side of the coin there, I suppose.
That's a really good one. He would certainly have won the championship in 1994 because Damon Hill just failed to win it just about, so I think Senna would have won that. Damon managed to give it away in 95, so I think Senna would have won that. He would have won it in 96 as well, if he was still around, and 97. So he would have been massive in terms of statistics.
This is Mark Chapman with Five Live Sport, where we're discussing the life and times of Ayrton Senna in the company of John Watson, Morris Hamilton and James Gay Rees, the producer of the new film, Senna. We've touched a lot, obviously, on his driving ability and his character on the track, James. What came through from all the archive of him off the track?
Off the track, I mean, I think what came through really was, I think it was that there's a great scene in the film where he basically talks about time and not having that much time left, maybe as a racing driver, but having more time as a man to continue to grow. I think it relates to something that Bruno said earlier, that basically, you know, he was very, very dedicated to being the best driver, but also the best man that he could be. And obviously the two things for him were linked to some extent. But I find it really quite inspiring the way his approach to basically, you know, his life in general. And that was really interesting to see, because we have all sportsmen obviously are motivated to, you know, train hard and be the best they can be. But his kind of worldview was a bit broader than that.
A family man, a religious man.
Very, very religious. I mean, his sister, Viviani, who we're very close to now, is equally religious. And I think it was really after Monaco in 88 when he basically crashed out after being way ahead. And that really, at that point, I think he asked Viviani for some sort of way to kind of focus himself. And she suggested, you know, the Bible and certain passages in the Bible. And he got more and more into it. And, you know, as it says in the movie, you know, when he wins the world championship in 88, he actually claims to have seen God on the track, you know, literally hanging above the track. He was in such a heightened state of kind of focus and so in the zone that he had some kind of vision. And I think it's been interpreted in a number of different ways, but there's this fascinating article in Playboy magazine he gave where he really goes into it in a lot of detail and sort of talks about what God looked like. I mean, you know, it was pretty out there.
And how important was he to Brazil, and how important was Brazil to him?
I think he used to go to incredible lengths to go back to Brazil, didn't he? I mean, Ron Dennis told us that, you know, he'd take sort of three planes just in order to get back there for like two nights and then come back again. So I think he was clearly very important to Brazil, because at that point in time, as Bruno also referenced, you know, they weren't the country they are today. They didn't have the kind of they hadn't had this economic boom. It was the end of a dictatorship, a military dictatorship, the junta. And so I think, you know, he was their ray of sunshine. And there are some very telling moments and moving moments in the movie when basically, especially when he dies, when people say, my God, you know, the sun's gone out for us. That was the only thing we had. That was our little ray of joy. And now it's gone.
There's a quote in the film, Morris, from a lady who says it's the only thing we can be proud of in Brazil. And given the fact they actually have quite a rich sporting heritage, particularly on the football side of it, that's quite a statement.
Yes, motorsport really became very popular with the arrival of Emerson Fittipaldi in the 1970s, and it advanced hugely in terms of popularity. But it was the fact that Ayrton Senna was not only winning, but also he then adopted this habit of, on a slowing down lap where he could see a Brazilian flag, he'd carry it and he would wave it. And he knew, he picked up very quickly that the act of doing that was having a massive effect back home. For the reasons James has said, the country was in a bit of a poor state. And Ayrton had a fairly privileged background, and he was aware of that, and he was aware that the majority of people were not as well off as he was, and he was determined to do what he could to try and help that along and give them this ray of hope. But it was definitely a ray of hope that he was their hero. And perhaps with football, which is the one you'd think of, you're talking about a team there, or maybe the odd player, the Pelé, perhaps. But with Senna, it was what he was doing. He was beating the world consistently. This wasn't a World Cup once every 4 years. This was every fortnight. Mm. He was out representing Brazil, flying that flag and taking it onto the podium with him. They just loved it.
And winning his home Grand Prix was incredibly important to him. Tell us a story in the film about when he finally won his home Grand Prix, Jack.
It is extraordinary, actually, because he pulls out, he's in pole position, he pulls out a very healthy lead, and everybody thinks it's going to be a fairly sort of stock victory. And his car gets jammed in sixth gear. So I think it's something like the last 12 laps or something. He has to basically drive his car in sixth gear, which, I mean, you know, I've never driven a Formula One car, obviously, but I mean, Ron Dennis said it is doable. I don't know how you do it. But...
And basically what he had to do was just do everything very much more progressively and brake a lot earlier for a corner and pick up the throttle and then very gently just open the throttle to enable the engine to pick up.
Yeah.
I mean, it's obviously in a low-speed corner, it's much more difficult than a middle or a high-speed corner.
Are there very fine margins in doing that?
Well, it's just a matter of working it out, first of all. If you were to come out to a corner and then try to go around it in sixth gear, where normally you'd take second gear and brake at your normal point, you probably wouldn't do it. So if you brake maybe 30, 40 metres earlier and get the speed off, and then it's picking up the throttle to enable the engine then to do what it's meant to do and sort of trickle around the corner, but using the engine to let you to pull you through rather than just letting the engine almost die, which it would have done under the normal style of driving.
The thing in those days, I mean, the cars, I mean, again, you tell me, but I mean, one gets the sense that the cars were much harder work to drive in those days than they are today.
Don't tell the modern Grand Prix driver that. He'll wonder why he's getting paid 15, 20 million pounds a year. No, the cars were different because there was none of the mechanical aids or the power steering.
Yeah.
The loads today are higher than they were at this particular time, 85 up onwards, 93, 94. So it's a different style of Grand Prix racing. But those cars, they didn't have pit stops unless it was a forced pit stop. You didn't have refuelling, which is now banned. You didn't have tyre changes. Your car, you had to set up prior to going into the race. And the skill in getting a good race car, and this is where Alain Prost was particularly successful, was getting the car, not necessarily for that one close your eyes and hope you're going to make the lap in qualifying, but to get the car to go through 65 or 70 laps of the Interlagos circuit, which is extremely demanding on a race car.
Yeah.
And it took winning that Grand Prix in, and doing it in sixth gear for the final 12 laps took its toll on him.
It did. I mean, he sort of collapses in the car at the end. I mean, he's absolutely euphoric, and then he's completely spent. And you see him in the car; he can't move. He's having awful muscle spasms in his neck and his back. And Professor Sid Watkins has to kind of basically sort of peel him out of the car. And then there's that lovely scene. He can't quite raise the trophy at the end. He's kind of literally needs three goes to do it.
And there's also that lovely scene as he's out and he meets his father, and he wants to embrace him, and he says to his father, "No, careful, don't touch me," because his back is in spasm. But he wants to hug his father, yeah. and he just about can manage it. I'd never seen that before, and that's part of this film. The clips you've got, James, things like that we've never seen before. Really, really good.
We're going to talk Imola in just a second. But before we do, after his death, his sister set up the Ayrton Senna Foundation.
Yeah.
In the past 16 years, it's helped 14 million children in Brazil.
It is phenomenal. I mean, you know, it's an incredible endeavour. And they don't have any money assistance from the government. It's all through basically licensing deals and donations, I think. And they do an enormous amount of good. I mean, they're very high profile and they have a lot of the kind of, you know, Ronaldo, their sportsmen kind of really, you know, do support it. But it's, you know, I mean, probably the situation in Brazil is much improved from when Ayrton was around. But, I mean, there's still obviously a huge amount of poverty in Brazil. And they did make a big difference.
To Imola then, and 1994, Senna had a poor start to the season with Williams. He'd moved to them at the start of the year. He'd had problems with the first three races. He'd retired. He wasn't comfortable yet. You were both there, weren't you, Morris?
Yes.
And John,
yes.
That weekend. And it, even before the actual race, it had been a terrible weekend for Formula One.
First of all, Rubens Barrichello, the next generation of Brazilian driver, had a very, very nasty accident just literally short of the start-finish line when the car got airborne, flew into the debris fencing and tore the car apart, potentially a fatal accident. And, of course, Ayrton was curious and interested to know why it happened, to find out how Rubens was. But then the big shock, the thing that really sent shivers down the entire paddock, was the tragic accident of Roland Ratzenberger, a horrible high-speed accident, probably the quickest part of the circuit. Structural failure in the front of the car, and the driver was a complete passenger, hit the wall on the outside of the circuit. I don't know what speed he was doing, but high, high speed, and killed instantly. And that was the first time a racing driver had been killed in a motor racing accident, as opposed to Elio De Angelis' tragic death in 86 in a testing accident, since, I think, 82, when Ricardo Paletti was the last driver to die in Canada. And again, drivers become accustomed to not having fatal accident. If you go back to the 50s and the 60s, it was an occupational hazard. You knew that it was going to happen to a certain number of drivers per year. I can do the calculations. Jackie Stewart did the calculations. We took the risks. We knew the risks. We hoped that we believed it might not be us. But this sort of false sense of almost infallibility had crept into Formula One. The car safety had improved dramatically over the previous 10 years. Circuit safety had improved as well. Compared to today, it was miles out of date.
And it really affected Ayrton Senna going into that race on the Sunday.
It did. And one of the many moving clips from the film Senna, which had, again hadn't been seen before, I think James is right to say there was one of the Williams sponsors would have been filming there that weekend. And when the tragedy occurred in the race, then that film was shelved, and then you've got it, and there's clips in it used from that. And the one that really struck me was the camera is focused on Ayrton as he's out of the car. Ratzenberger's had his accident, and there's a TV screen high up in the garage, and you can see he's looking at it. And then you see a clip of what he's watching, and it's the medical team trying to resuscitate Ratzenberger, and it's pretty clear what's happened. And the look on Senna's face just says everything. He's questioning the whole lot, and he can't look at it anymore, and he has to walk away. It doesn't say anything, but it says everything. And the effect on him at that moment is profound. You can see it.
To such an extent that he didn't want to race on the Sunday?
I don't know. I mean, there's a very famous interview with his girlfriend at the time, Adriana Galisteo, and apparently on the night before, he calls her in absolute bits and says, I just can't do it. I have such a bad feeling about tomorrow. I really don't want to do it. And then the next morning, he does race. I'm sorry, she speaks to him again, and he says, actually, no, I'm going to race. It's going to be fine. I'm strong. I'm up for it. And when we first pitched Viviani Senna the idea, as we referred to earlier in Sao Paulo, at the end of the pitch, very moving, everybody very emotional. She said to us, I'm going to tell you something now that I've never told anybody outside of the family before. And she said, on the morning of the race, when Leonardo, his brother, was driving him to the track, he said, pull over the car. And she said, why? We've got to get there. No, pull over the car. I've got to tell you something. What is it? And basically, he said, you know, I was reading the Bible this morning. I opened the Bible up, and I read a passage which fundamentally said, God is going to give me the greatest gift of all today, which is basically God himself. And you can interpret that in a number of different ways, but it sort of does suggest he has this kind of feeling that basically, you know, it's his time.
Is it true that there was, when you were going through all the film of that weekend, James, you didn't find any where he was smiling? He just looked pretty preoccupied the whole time.
Yeah, I mean, especially after the Ratzenberger crash, when he really just looks incredibly out of sorts and just doesn't really, in relation to your earlier question, did he ever lose his passion? I mean, it's the only bit of footage I ever saw where he actually didn't look like he wanted to drive. And this is a guy who lived to drive, basically. So it was pretty distilling to see that.
When you sat down to make the film, this event was presumably the most difficult to work out how to cover it in the film.
There aren't that many angles to use of the actual crash itself. And also, I mean, I think it wasn't really in keeping with the tone of the film to kind of be too gory on the nose about it. But there are only two shots and they're both quite wide. We had to be fairly straightforward with how we covered it. And it's really the build-up to it, which is where we try to rinse out as much tension as we can, because we stay in car with him for the entire lap prior to the crash, and it's
in silence with no commentary.
Yeah, just the sound of the engine and him changing gears. And you know it's coming, but you're not quite sure when.
Mm. He'd had a conversation as well, according to Sid Watkins, about them both retiring.
And Sid had said, come up to Scotland, we'll do a bit of salmon fishing. And we were talking about that before we went on air. But Sid's a great angler, and Ayrton was a very close friend and almost a confidant, somebody outside of the family that he trusted. And I think trust was something that if he didn't trust you, he wouldn't communicate. And Sid had his trust. Now, in the same hotel that evening, I saw Sid and we sat and talked about the Ratzenberger accident. I wanted to understand it as a broadcaster. Mm. Why had it happened? What had been the consequences of it? And Ayrton had also wanted to go into it in great detail to fully understand it, as we saw in the film, or looking at the screens, turning away from it, the realisation that this is a fatal accident. I don't think Sid said to me that he was not prepared to race. And I think he was upset or unsettled. Now, the story about coming into the circuit on Sunday morning, having a premonition. If I had a premonition, I would make sure I didn't actually do anything to go that direction. So I'm not quite clear as to where all this stuff about having a vision and, you know, maybe he had in his own mind, but I can't go there particularly. So I think also when the race started, we had this false start because of the accident. Then the period, the restart, then the period behind the safety car and so on and so forth. But to me, when a racing driver gets into the car and the helmet is on and the focus changes, all those thoughts, in my view, would dissipate because your concentration is so intense and deep, you can't allow that to interfere. Otherwise, you could become a danger to yourself and to other drivers. But the other thing I noted in the race during the commentary was that Michael Schumacher, who was the enfant terrible at this stage, he was going to be the natural successor to Ayrton Senna, was putting pressure. We talked about a little bit of the bullying effect. He was doing to Ayrton the very thing that Ayrton had done to other drivers years earlier, and doing it, and Ayrton sensed that the Benetton, the car that Schumacher was driving, which was not meant to have some driver aids, was still somehow or other able to access them, which irritated him because his car had none of that. Yet his pride and his, you know, his position, if you like, in the paddock as the Formula One driver, the ambassador for Formula One as a driver, was being challenged by an upstart in a car that may have been not legal.
Ayrton Senna's death, for me, is one of only two or three that I can remember exactly where I was at that moment. As we've said, both you two were there. Morris, in the aftermath that night, what was it like? And in the days after, both for you personally and for the sport?
Well, being of a certain age, I was, as John was saying, I do remember the time when there were a lot of fatalities. Your hero is always the guy when you're in your teens. That's when you form your hero. For me, it was Jim Clark. And I can remember exactly where I was when I heard that he'd died.
So can I.
And for the same reason.
Yeah.
And so I knew that motor racing can be dangerous. The thing that struck me, and I wasn't ready for it, when I walked into the paddock in Imola after the race and the news had been given out that Ayrton was declared dead in the hospital, was obviously a lot of people were in deep shock. But the number of younger people who'd been around, say, in the previous 10 years, who said, one person said to me, I didn't realise this sort of thing could happen. And I couldn't believe it. But, of course, they didn't know any better, as John said, because we'd had this period of 12 years without a fatality at a race. So they thought that when a driver has an accident, he steps out, brushes himself down, everything's all right. Mm. But I had to say, no, actually, it's quite a dangerous sport. This can happen. And that really brought it home to me. For me, it was terrible shock, because we hadn't had one for such a long time. But that is the nature of the beast. Sadly, it will happen occasionally. But it was a profound shock for the whole of Formula One because of it was who it was. And also, the weekend itself was awful.
Yeah. And in Brazil, James, the reaction in the subsequent days, and then his funeral was a national wake, really.
Oh, it was incredible. I mean, it's like 3 days or 5 days of national mourning, and I think, you know, sort of 2 million people turned out on the streets of Sao Paulo to see his kind of coffin go by. I think one girl even committed suicide. I mean, it was extraordinary, the kind of emotional reaction to it. And it goes back to that thing. It just, you know, it was kind of, they felt a real sense of loss and a loss of hope. And yeah, I mean, very, very tough times. And I think it took them all. I think it was very strange showing the film in Brazil now, because it's such a different country now. They're so confident now, Brazilians. They've got so much going for them. And I think the film was half them, A, because of, obviously, they remembered the loss, but also it took them back to a time when they didn't have the confidence and they didn't have the kind of, you know, the ambition they have now.
The beauty of a show like this is that you can finish with a sort of a list, I suppose, and try and place drivers or place sporting heroes and where they stand. Where does Ayrton Senna stand in a list of great racing drivers, John?
Well, in my list of drivers of this generation, Ayrton is the driver that I feel was the driver that did it for me, amongst great drivers like Alan Prost, Nigel Mansell, a few others. But there was something, I think, extra special about Ayrton, in the same way that the driver who I would probably choose as my all-time hero, Juan Manuel Fangio, who won 5 world championships and retired to Argentina at a time when it was extremely dangerous. That's my all time. But within that generation of drivers of Mansell, Prost, Senna, whoever else, Ayrton did it for me big time. I mean, just those 65 qualifying laps, standing watching them, Monaco, Imola, wherever, he had the car, I mean, literally dancing like thunderstorm bouncing off tarmac. It just takes you back thinking about it. Unbelievable. Never seen anything subsequently that matches it.
But Fangio will go ahead, what, because it was a because of your age at the time, because of it was a more dangerous era?
Primarily because I think at the point when Fangio was achieving his 5 world championships, I was even younger than a teenager. I was going through this formative motor racing thing and dreaming about maybe one day I'm being a Grand Prix driver. But also, I think it was the manner in which Fangio achieved his success. And he was a different man to Ayrton. He achieved it in a magnificent way, with grace, possibly. That's the word I would use.
Maurice?
Yeah, that's the point. I think that it's the way that Fangio achieved it. I mean, this question about who's the greatest, it's one of those things that's so difficult to answer.
But it's great to discuss, isn't it?
It is, because drivers from different generations have got different problems, they've got different circumstances and so on. I think Bruno Senna touched on it when he said that his uncle was the fastest, and he was, of that particular generation, and possibly of all time, blindingly fast, for the reason we described with that lap I saw at the swimming pool at Monaco. Just unbelievable.
Well, isn't it interesting, because when you watch archive of sporting events, when you go sort of in whatever sport it is generally, it always looks slower. As a sport, whatever the sport is, compared to modern day sport, and actually looking at a lot of the Formula One from Ayrton Senna's time, to me, it actually looks quicker and more exciting and more thrilling.
Well, there's a lot of lovely onboard stuff in the film, particularly I think it's Suzuka, and it's wonderful to watch. And that's because Ayrton is so urgent in the way he drives the car that it becomes, you're right, because he makes it look quick because he's on the edge all the time. And they had a manual gearbox in those days, and he's busy in the cockpits. So, yes, you're right.
Ayrton didn't do blunt. Everything was razor blade sharp.
But would you agree with me?
Absolutely.
I don't know.
If you think the modern car tends to look like it's glued to the racetrack. Mm. But in fact, if you look just last weekend at Monte Carlo, Lewis Hamilton, Jenson Button and the McLarens through the swimming pool complex. I mean, Lewis, I just saw Ayrton Senna on that. Jenson had the car floating through it serenely. I mean, the difference in time was non-measurable. But Lewis is in there and he's got the car by the scruff of the neck and he's driving the wheels off it, doing the same thing Ayrton did. But the cars 25 years ago didn't have the downforce, so they physically were moving around a great deal more, which gives maybe an impression of speed that we don't see today.
Interestingly, a text came in about Lewis Hamilton, Morris, which said, do you think somebody needs to tell him to tone it down or he could end up causing a serious accident? comparing him
to
Senna.
We need another hour for that answer.
Well, I do.
You've only got 2 minutes.
I do. Funny enough, I have been writing a blog on that very subject. And I put a tweet up to ask people to get a reaction. What do you think? And 70% are in favour of Lewis Hamilton, what he does on the racetrack. They love watching it. But people were saying, but somebody needs to have a little word in his ear. Calm down. Because out of the car, he's letting himself down and he needs to calm down. But in the car, he's fantastic. And John's right. He reminds me so much of Senna, yellow helmet, the whole bit. Mm.
The greatest for you, James Senna?
Listen, I'm a different generation slightly, but I mean, for me, I think so, definitely. I mean, I think he definitely trumps Schumacher. That's the kind of modern competition, isn't it, in a sense, in terms of this big debate. I think, he was pure box office, no doubt about it. And I do think, imagine him in that Red Bull car now. I mean, what would he be like with that car? I mean, it'd just be absurd, wouldn't it? So for me, yeah, but I'm just a fan of him as a man, full stop.
But also your support of him and being a fan of him comes from stories about him being passed down to you from your father, which in many ways is what sport is about. You learn your sport from what your father passes down to you.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, I was thinking about this because we had the premiere last night and we all gave a little speech, and it's very rare that films come, have that sort of genesis whereby, it's something you discuss with your dad and you end up making a film about it, 25 years later. And it's kind of cute. But no, he just, for me, he has that X factor. I can't take my eyes off him. Even having watched 5,000 hours of footage, I still find him incredibly watchable.
So the film is Senna, and it's out on general release from tomorrow.
Yeah.
Exactly. And you've heard it reviewed Van Morris and John both giving it ringing endorsements. Thank you very much for coming in this evening.
Pleasure.
It's been a pleasure. James Gay Rees and John Watson and Morris Hamilton, thank you very much for your thoughts and your expertise. It's been a pleasure.
On digital and online. This is BBC Radio 5 Live. 5 Lives, Checkered Flag Podcast.